squeal of the tires on the tar is not out of place on the road. Most of the group of pedestrians walking on the pavement don't even react to the noise at first. But then, everything changes. The cars are no longer on the road. There's no time to move. It all happens so fast. Within seconds, multiple lives are changed. And as the dust clears, the horror becomes evident. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 166, Death on Mdlaloze Street. This week's sponsor is When Change Happens, a podcast series about ordinary South Africans coping with extraordinary changes in their lives and hosted by legendary journalist Ruda Landman. Subscribe to Change in One Generation on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Iono, or go to changepodcasts.co.za for more information. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You? Yes, you. Are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Connie Drake and Christelle LaRue. Thank you so much for your support, everyone. It really does make a big difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Keba. Today's case is perhaps not the type of crime you may think about being one for a true crime episode, but that's only because they're not usually covered. Deaths through vehicular trauma are probably one of the most common ways that people are killed, though. In 2018, there were 12,921 reported road fatalities in South Africa. According to the 2018-2019 SAPS crime statistics, in that same period, 32,000 people were murdered in South Africa. Now, a murder is registered as such when the circumstances of the crime criteria of that charge, and often road fatalities are not investigated outright as murders. Usually they'll start as culpable homicide investigations, and if the criteria fit in court, that can be escalated. So there could be some crossover between the two numbers, but it's very likely minimal. Because in my experience, at least, road fatalities very often don't make it to court. They are one of the types of cases that can easily be swept under the rug, and what we deem as car accidents are often not so accidental at all, especially when there is very clear negligence or willful breaking of the law which leads to death. I guess the irony of this episode is that I am able to cover this case because the perpetrators were well-known individuals, so their actions made the news. But my thoughts remained with the many thousands of South Africans who lose their lives on our roads every year and don't ever get justice. In researching this episode, my sources included an article in the Sivamis publication, several online resources, and several media articles. So, let's get into episode 166, Death on Mdlaloza Street.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Illegal street racing is not a new problem in South Africa, and it doesn't even have to be organized. How many times have we heard someone talking about how they pulled up next to another vehicle and then diced them, as the South African colloquialism goes? The danger involved in these illegal races are multiple, even when there is no substances involved. It's not only dangerous for those racing, but also other unsuspecting cars who may be sharing the same public road. And if it's a highway, it's one thing. But if it happens on suburban roads and you add pedestrians into the mix, it can become disastrous. Often the individuals involved in illegal racing are famous or successful in some way. They have a good amount of money and they have relatively expensive and fast cars. And sometimes substance use and abuse comes with that type of lifestyle too, as seems to have been what happened in today's case. As I mentioned earlier, one of the individuals who perpetrated this crime was relatively well known, and I'll get into a bit of his background, but I'm hesitant to share too much of the extensive information about his family and other issues around the individual, because I don't really want it to overshadow the victims too much. Molemo Katleho Maroyane was born on the 29th of June 1980. He was the eldest son of Sydney and Jacqueline Maroyane and grew up with four siblings in Orlando East, Soweto, before the family moved to the southern suburbs of Johannesburg. The young man, who would go on to become known as Jub Jub in the public domain, was a child star who was discovered in 1990. Starring in a popular Coca-Cola TV advertisement that featured soccer legend Dr. Kumalo and an Nkomazi advert, which was also incredibly popular. When Molemo was ready for high school, he won a place at the prestigious LaGuardia High School for Performing Arts in New York City. He appeared in several television shows and films after that, and eventually his career developed into one in music. He celebrated several hits in the hip-hop genre and was for the most part a well-loved celebrity. As is the case with most famous musicians and television or film stars, Molemo's love life was also the subject of constant public fascination, and he dated several high-profile women, including Amanda DuPont and Kelly Kumalo, with whom he would have a son. In 2006, Molemo's family went through a rather rough patch when his mother, a well-known businesswoman, was exposed for some rather dubious dealings. And although the family would not know it, this would mark the beginning of an even more difficult period for them and many others. In 2009, Molemo participated in a season of the reality show Survivor. The celebrity edition was created to raise funds for various charities, and the longer the participants managed to stay on the show, the larger the amount would be that was donated to their chosen charity. Molemo had chosen the Ituteng Trust for his winnings to be donated to, but after he only made two episodes before dropping out due to a skin rash, It was revealed when the season aired in 2010 that the charity he'd chosen was run by his mother, and according to a carte blanche expose, actually was not registered. The 20,000 rand that had allegedly been donated to the trust by the television program was eventually rerouted to another verifiable charity. 2010, though, would not get any better for the young man. On the 8th of March 2010, Molemo had met with a friend of his, Themba Tshabalala. The two men would later say that their meeting had been business-related. Molemo was apparently thinking about starting a shisanyama at his father's butchery, and Themba owned a bottle store, so the men were going to discuss working together, with Themba supplying alcohol to the proposed new venue. Later, Themba would deny that he was Molemo's friend, and he said he'd only met him to discuss business. Both the men drove Mini Coopers. Molemo's was a charcoal grey and Themba's was blue. At some point, the men got into their vehicles. Themba said he was headed to pick up one of his siblings, but by 3 p.m, both men were on La Loze Street in Protea Glen, Soweto. Altmont Technical High School in Soweto and Jules High School in Jeppestown had closed at 3 p.m. that day, and learners from both schools were walking down Mdlaloze Street as they headed home. As the pavements bustled with pedestrians, the two Mini Coopers came into view. 17-year-old Ntokoza Matlangu was walking down Mdlaloze Street that day. As soon as she saw the two Mini Coopers, she said she knew who was driving the grey one. Molemo, or Jubjub as he was known to his fans, was well known in the neighbourhood. Ntokozo lifted her phone and started recording. The two cars took up the entire road as their speed increased and they overtook one another. The speed limit on Mdlaloze Street was 60 kilometres per hour. Investigators would later estimate that at the top speed they'd been doing at that point, the vehicles were likely going 108 and 112 kilometres per hour, respectively. Ntokozo's phone quickly ran out of memory, though, and stopped recording. Seconds after it did, disaster struck. In the midst of an overtaking manoeuvre, one vehicle clipped the other, and suddenly both were veering out of control. It all happened far too quickly for most of the pedestrians to react. 1 minute they were vaguely aware of two minis speeding beside them, and the next, the blue vehicle was flying through the air and through the crowd, landing on its roof. The grey mini spun out and ended up crashing into a tree. The screams that had started the minutes the cars had left the road did not stop as the dust settled. Rather, they increased in intensity. There were school children under the blue car, pinned, and others laying around, badly injured. The scene was chaos. While some bystanders called police and ambulances, others tried to assist the injured, and still others turned on the drivers of the vehicles. Some witnesses alleged that Themba had tried to leave the scene and had to be brought back, and Molemo had immediately made a phone call and walked around on his phone. Tensions were high as ambulances arrived and began to treat the injured. Although neither Themba nor Molemo had sustained any serious injuries, they were taken into the back of one of the ambulances. Angry members of the community started to bang on the back of the ambulance until the men got out so that more of the children with injuries could be treated. Eventually, police would have to remove the two men from the scene as the crowd began to surge and demand the men be handed over to them. It was already clear that some of the children had died. There were horrific injuries, and gruesome scenes paired with the knowledge that the two drivers had been speeding, and some said racing, soon reached fever pitch. By the time the scene was cleared, four children had lost their lives, and two more were rushed to hospital in critical condition. The four deceased victims were Andile Montembi, Prince Mohube, Mlungisi Tswayi, and Pomelo Masemola. Three of the boys had sustained serious head and neck injuries, with one victim experiencing a complete severing of his spinal cord from his skull. The fourth victim had sustained injuries to almost all of his body, and one of his splintered ribs had pierced his heart, causing devastating organ failure. Molemo would later claim that he had only realized anyone had died when he'd left the scene. He had not been alone in his vehicle. A female friend was with him. She too had been uninjured in the accident, and he says that she told him after they'd been taken away by police that some of the children had died. One of the police officers who'd taken control of the scene and decided to take the men away to reduce the tension within the crowd would later say that as soon as he'd approached Temba Shabalala, he'd smelled alcohol on his breath. The officer also said that when he'd spoken with Molemo Maronyane, the young man had been constantly rubbing his nose, and the officer had said he'd experienced this behaviour many times before when an individual had been using cocaine. Due to the nature of the incident and the warning signs of intoxication from the drivers, the two were transported to a centre where their urine and blood samples could be taken for testing. Over the next few hours, several different waves of impact spread out from Dlaloze Street. The first was through the media, who were set abuzz with the news that a well-known actor and musician had been involved in a deadly car crash after allegedly illegally street racing. Molemo would later complain that the media had painted him in a negative light from within an hour of the crash occurring, and he felt that he would never receive a fair trial as a result, as he was sure witnesses had been tainted by false reporting. I will admit that a lot of what I remember being reported about this case, at least in the initial days, turned out to be quite an exaggeration, and sometimes even blatantly incorrect. But I didn't follow the case closely during the trial, and it would be then that the evidence of the truth would be laid bare. The other wave of impact was felt by the families of the children, as they were contacted and advised that their sons had been killed or were severely injured. Selina Dasheka had been on Dlaloze Street when the minis had come off the road and the four children had been killed. Devastatingly, in the seconds before Temba Shabalala's car had come flying into the crowd, Selina had recognized her neighbor's son, Mlungisi Tswaye, in the crowd. And then, as the dust settled, she couldn't find the boy, until the paramedics moved in to attempt to work on the injured, and Selina realized Mlungisi was among the four deceased boys. Mlungisi was unidentifiable physically due to his injuries, but Selina had been very sure it was him. In shock, she had gone home, and when Mlungisi's mother returned home, she'd come over to Selina's house, as she'd heard rumours that her son may have been among the injured or dead, and someone had told her that Selina had been there. Mlungisi's mom was frantic, and Selina would later testify in court that the woman had been overcome by emotion when she'd heard that Mlungisi could be dead, so much so that she'd punched Selina in the chest and stormed out of the house. After the initial wave of emotion subsided, Selina accompanied Mlungisi's mom to the police station to determine whether it had indeed been her son who had been killed. One by one, the other families, friends, Teachers and schoolmates of the victims were advised of their deaths, and although grief was the first reaction, rage soon followed. At the first court appearance of Molemo Maronyane and Temba Shabalala on the 10th of March 2010, a huge crowd of schoolchildren gathered outside the court. They chanted for the men to be handed over to them so that they could provide what they felt was true justice, and threw stones at police vehicles they thought may be carrying the men. If Molemo and Temba had hoped that they may face lesser charges of culpable homicide or reckless and negligent driving, their hopes would be dashed when they were charged in the highest order. 4 charges of murder and 2 charges of attempted murder each. The 2 boys who had been severely injured, Fumani Mushwana and Frank Mlambo, were still in hospital at that point. Fumani's prognosis was good and he would be released soon after, but still had a long road of recovery ahead of him, learning to walk, talk and feed himself again. But Frank had sustained serious brain injuries, and the teenager had been left with the mental capacity of a 2-year-old, according to neurosurgeons. Molemo and Temba had been returned to jail awaiting their bail hearing, which happened on the 17th of March. This time, police were prepared for the angry students and had a water cannon and rubber bullets at the ready. The courthouse was barricaded off, and entrance was barred to members of the public. Tensions ran high as students expressed their disgust at Jubjub's behaviour. Death threats towards the 2 men and anyone who supported them were issued, and eventually, although most of the crowd had dispersed, a particularly volatile group of students had rubber bullets fired at them until they eventually moved off. Inside the courthouse, the bail hearing commenced, and evidence was presented that helped elucidate the progression to murder charges. The prosecutor said that the urine and blood analyses on the 2 men had shown that Temba was twice the legal limit on alcohol when the crash happened, and both men's urine had shown traces of cocaine and morphine. The accident investigator's initial assessment of the speed the men had to have been going to cause the damage they did was also presented. Defence counsel insisted that they would refute the drug and alcohol claims as well as the speeding accusations in court. As far as bail went, the magistrate was initially hesitant to grant bail to the 2 men as the community was in such an uproar, but eventually it was determined that there was not enough cause to refuse bail, and so both Temba and Molemo were granted bail of 10,000 rand each. Molemo hired a private security company to provide protection for him and his family. The victims' families were not happy that the 2 men were being released on bail, but they had funerals and memorials to attend to. Andile Mthombeni was laid to rest at the village his family had originally lived in the Eastern Cape. Several of his schoolmates and teachers attended the funeral. 2 of his friends spoke and said they had once been fans of Jubjub's music, but would no longer listen to it now that he was accused of murdering their friend. Of Andile, his friends said, quote, "He was very disciplined. We had formed a group with Kaiser Mdake, and the 3 of us used to debate matters. He liked music and liked 50 Cent a lot. He also liked soccer. The local team he supported was Kaiser Chiefs, while he supported Liverpool internationally. And he was very intelligent and very up to date. You could consult him on anything educational and he would have the answers." End quote. 17-year-old Tamsanka Prince Mohube was also laid to rest around this time. His funeral in Soweto was also attended by many of his fellow school friends. His aunt spoke about her nephew, saying, quote, "Prince, you were your mother's pride. When your peers stood at street corners, you were at your soccer training. End quote. Prince was an up-and-coming soccer star, and his coach, who also attended, spoke about the bright future the young man had in the sport. His teacher told a touching story to a journalist about some of the last hours of Prince's life. The young man had submitted an assignment later than the due date, and to make up for this, he'd offered to sweep the teacher's classroom. The teacher said he'd finished off and laughed and joked with her for a bit and then left. She'd marked his assignment as he'd probably just started walking down La Loze Street. Perhaps as the Mini Cooper flew through the air, his teacher had written his mark down, 65 out of 75. And as she drew a large red circle around the numbers, maybe Prince was taking his final breaths. An hour later, the teacher received a telephone call letting her know of the devastating news. Prince, who was also called Tami, short for Tam Sanka, like all other soccer-loving youths in South Africa, had been overjoyed at the prospect of the country hosting the Soccer World Cup later that year. Now, instead of sharing space with some of his heroes and reveling in the atmosphere, Tami was buried with his soccer kit. Pomolelo Masemola was the first-born son of his family, who were lineage of a royal family in their tribe of origin in Limpopo. Pomolelo was a prince, something many of his friends only discovered after his death. And so his burial in Limpopo was attended by many traditional leaders and was a deeply traditional and spiritual event. Pomolelo's mother had managed to remain relatively calm throughout the event, but the act of throwing soil into her son's grave had her grief overwhelming her, and she had to be supported to stand by family members. As everyone waited for the trial to begin, Molemo found that he was persona non grata within the industry, and many brands and individuals who had partnered with him had pulled away while he tended to the charges against him. He and Themba Tshabalala both maintained that they were not guilty of the charges and intended to defend themselves at trial. When the trial started in December 2010, the prosecution opened its case with several witnesses to the events that day. These included members of the public who had been walking along Mdlaloze Street at the time the crash took place. All of these witnesses testified to similar evidence. They had seen two Mini Coopers, one grey and one blue, driving at high speeds, side by side on the road. Some spoke of a clipping of wheels by one car on the other, and others testified merely that the cars had lost control at some point and left the road. The defence did their best to mitigate this evidence, asking witnesses how they could claim that the men were racing when they had no insight into their intentions while they drove. The witnesses said that they felt they could confidently say this because they had witnessed street racing several times before, and from the way the cars were moving, it was clear that they were racing. One witness was asked why she thought she was qualified to say that the cars were moving at a high rate of speed, as she didn't have a driver's license. The witness said she didn't feel she needed to know how to drive to know what a vehicle looked like when it moved far faster than 60 kilometers per hour. One witness stated that Molemo's vehicle had been on the wrong side of the road as he sought to overtake Temba, and when another vehicle had been driving toward him, he'd had to veer into Temba's lane to avoid a collision. It was believed that this may have been the point at which the wheel clipping occurred, which had possibly resulted in both drivers losing control. The very next witness added a surprising and alarming twist to the tale. The man had been the driver of the vehicle that had almost collided with Molemo that day. He'd been driving a school transport van and had 12 schoolchildren in the vehicle when he'd seen the charcoal Mini driving straight at him. Having no idea whether the Mini driver would avert an accident, the man had swerved off the road, thankfully into an area with no pedestrians, and his passengers had not been injured. The police officers who had worked on the case that day and since then also testified about the important elements of their investigation. Accident scene investigator Penelope Shivambu testified that she'd used a combination of forensic tools, some video footage, and witness testimony to reconstruct the events of the day the crash occurred. She'd been able to ascertain that Molemo had been driving on the wrong side of the road, and witnesses had said the men were engaged in a race when Molemo had suddenly swerved back into the other lane to avoid hitting the school transport vehicle. Although there were witnesses who said that the vehicle's wheels had collided at this point, Shivambu said she could find no evidence that a collision had occurred prior to the two vehicles leaving the road, and she believed it may have been the swerving action from Molemo which had caused both vehicles to lose control. Although both Molemo and Temba denied that they were exceeding the speed limit or that they were racing, Officer Shivambu said that from all the accounts at the scene, as well as the tire track evidence, the cars had been speeding and driving beside one another, not simply overtaking, as Molemo claimed. During cross-examination, when Officer Shivambu was accused of tailoring her evidence to suit what the media had said about the men racing, she responded that she had not asked a single witness whether the men were racing. She had simply asked what had happened. Added to that, she said that most of the interviews were conducted within a few hours of the event, so it would be unlikely that any of the witnesses would have been influenced by the media. She also didn't see significant similarities in their statements, which could point to them having taken their versions from an external source. Rather, everyone's versions differed in the small ways she would expect from truthful renditions, other than to confirm that the men had been speeding and racing. As the trial continued, Molemo's life seemed to understandably be unravelling around him. He often arrived late for court appearances, and on more than one occasion he was accosted outside the courts by angry parents and protesters. His album sales plummeted, and many brands who had once partnered with him withdrew their support. The prosecution would go on to present several more witnesses in their case, including the doctors who had treated the injured boys, as well as the forensic pathologist who had conducted the autopsies on the four deceased victims. The officers and analysts who tested the urine and blood samples from Temba and Molemo also testified, and after this, the prosecution rested its case and the defence's case opened, with Molemo Maronyane taking the stand in his own defence on the 5th of December 2011. Although a few witnesses had claimed that they'd seen Molemo's vehicle hit the two schoolchildren who had survived their injuries before striking a tree, the state had yet to present any evidence from his vehicle to prove this. And in his testimony, Molemo denied hitting any human being before he'd struck the tree. I would imagine that an accident reconstruction could have been able to identify the trajectories that each vehicle took and which victims were standing where, but I didn't see any mention of this in the information I found about the trial. Honestly, I can imagine it would have been quite difficult to determine exactly where the victims were originally and where they'd ended up after being injured, because the crowd of pedestrians was relatively large and the injured individuals were moved during treatment by the paramedics. With that said, it seems unlikely to me that all six individuals would have been injured by the single vehicle. In addition, when the prosecution witness testified that he'd seen Molemo's vehicle hit the two injured boys, his defense counsel had not countered that in cross-examination, and Molemo couldn't explain why he hadn't instructed his counsel to do so. Molemo also said that he had not been racing, and the only time he'd been in the oncoming lane was when he was overtaking Themba Tshabalala. He refuted the testimony that he and Themba had lined their cars up beside one another at the stop street and then started their race. He claimed that he and Themba had been driving normally in the correct lane and not exceeding the speed limit when he felt Temba's wheels clip his car's wheels and he'd lost control and hit the tree. He knew for a fact that he hadn't hit anyone, and when he'd hit the tree, he thought he may have lost consciousness for a while. Molemo denied that he'd been using drugs or alcohol on the day of the crash and eventually broke down on the stand and asked for a break. When he returned, he explained that he had been deeply scarred by the crash and everything that had happened since. He wanted the families to know that he had not killed their children and he was sorry for any part he'd played in the crash. In cross-examination, Molemo was asked how it was possible that he knew for a fact he hadn't hit anyone if he also simultaneously claimed he'd blacked out and didn't know what had happened afterwards. In his testimony, Molemo claimed that each and every one of the prosecution witnesses, including the police officers and the accident reconstruction specialist, were lying. He could not explain why all of the witnesses would want to lie to incriminate him, but insisted that none of what had been presented in court by the state was true. He also said that the drugs found in his blood and urine samples could have gotten there through environmental absorption if people around him were using the drugs, or the samples could have been purposefully tampered with, but according to him, he'd never used drugs in his life. When Themba Tshabalala took the stand, he too refuted much of the evidence presented by the prosecution. He didn't deny that his car had struck the four children who died, but he claimed that he hadn't been racing and he hadn't been intoxicated on either drugs or alcohol. He admitted that he had consumed one whiskey and water on the day of the crash, but he was sure he would not have been over the legal limit for driving. He reiterated that killing the children had not been intentional and he had lost control of his vehicle when Molemo's car had clipped his. With both sides of the case presented, the prosecution and defence rested, and the judge would now have to form a judgment. In October 2012, his verdict was delivered, and the judge found that the prosecution had proven that the two men were engaged in an illegal street race and were both far exceeding the speed limit when the crash occurred, which had resulted in the death of four children and serious injuries to two. He found both Molemo Maronyane and Themba Tshabalala guilty of four counts of murder and two counts of attempted murder. The judge also found that the two had been under the influence of drugs and, in Temba's case, also alcohol. Upon passing down this judgment, the judge withdrew the pair's bail and ordered that they remain in custody until he handed down his sentence. During the sentencing portion of the trial, Molemo's lawyer requested that his client be allowed to serve his sentence in community service rather than in prison. He claimed that Molemo wanted to open a trust fund for the victims and their families to help them heal, and he would not be able to do this from prison. Themba was silent throughout the sentencing portion of the trial. In delivering his sentence, the judge said, quote, "No one can sympathize with you as you brought this on yourselves. Those kids left home in the morning to go to school, to better their lives, and the lives of their families. As they were upstanding citizens, they did not go to town. They decided to go straight home. They did not arrive home that day. The other two who escaped death will never be regarded as productive members of the community. The father of one of the survivors said that he would send his son to get some water, and by the time he reaches the fridge, he would have forgotten what he needed to get. End quote. The judge went on to say that he could have handed down life sentences to the two men, but due to their age and the fact that their behaviour could be rehabilitated through programs, he decided against that. But, he said, he felt it was important to hand down sentences lengthy enough to show how serious the crimes were and to hopefully deter others from driving while intoxicated and racing on the streets. He handed down 20 years incarceration to each man for murder and 4 years incarceration for attempted murder. They were also sentenced to 1 year for driving under the influence of drugs, 1 year for drag racing on a public road, and 1 year for using drugs. The latter three periods were ordered to run concurrently, so in total they received 27 years incarceration each, but would serve an effective 25 years behind bars. Both defense counsel immediately requested leave to appeal the conviction and the sentence, which was granted. When their initial appeal before the same judge was heard in February 2013, Temba indicated he wanted to only appeal his sentence, while Molemo confirmed he wished to appeal both his conviction and his sentence. The same judge who had passed down the conviction and sentence refused the appeal. But the men could still appeal to the High Court and higher up if need be, and in November 2013, their appeal was heard in the South Gauteng High Court. On this occasion, the men were successful in their appeal, and they were acquitted of the murder and attempted murder charges, and in their stead, found guilty of culpable homicide. In this case, the determination of murder required that the judge find that the men could have foreseen that their actions could have caused serious injury or death. In the original trial, the judge had decided that the men could have understood the possible impact of their actions despite them being impaired by intoxication, and actually found the intoxication to be an aggravating factor and sentenced them separately for that. In the appeal at the High Court, though, that judge found that because of the drug and alcohol use, the men may not have foreseen the results of their actions, and therefore found that they could not be guilty of murder. As there is no culpable homicide equivalent to attempted murder, those charges and the accompanying sentences were set aside completely. The men were given a reduced sentence of 10 years each. They would be eligible for parole at halfway through that, so 2015, and in 2017, both Molemo and Temba were granted parole. Molemo did a television interview shortly after his release on parole and expressed that his time in prison was the worst of his life, and he hoped to now help others to ensure they did not repeat the mistakes he had made. The year before Molemo was paroled, his mother was sent to prison for various convictions, including child trafficking. Molemo was able to get a new job in television and seems to be doing relatively well for himself. In 2022, a journalist from the City Press revisited some of the family members of the victims of the crash. The mother of Frank Mlambo, one of the boys injured on that day, said that in the wake of the crash she'd had to leave her job to care for her son full-time and had since ensured their survival by selling eggs and other food items from her home to get by. Martha Mlambo was incensed when she discovered that a rumour was circulating that after his release from prison, Molemo Maronyane had paid her 1 million rand in compensation and had ensured that Frank would be able to complete his education. She says that this is absolutely not true, and she had no idea where that rumour started. 3 years after his release, Molemo had remade one of his most successful songs, collaborating with several other big artists, and publicly said that all the proceeds of the song would go to the victims of the crash. But Martha says that she'd never heard from Molemo after he'd been released. Rather, the communication she had had from him was while he was still in prison. Martha says that in 2015, Molemo had called her and asked her what she needed to better her life. She told him that she was planning on taking up carpentry, and Molemo had told her he would pay for the course and whatever equipment she needed. Martha had mentioned an amount she'd need, but she'd never heard from him again. As an aside, 2015 would likely have also been when Molemo was eligible for parole for the first time. Martha said that her son is still struggling with the after effects of the crash and would likely never be able to work full time. I was not able to find any articles relating to monies paid over to the victims of the crash from Molemo's song release, but I will say that this may have been handled under the radar and not reported on, so this is not to say it didn't happen. But Martha Mlambo assured the journalists in 2022 that she had never received anything. In July 2023, Molemo Maronyane handed himself over to police when he was made aware of a warrant of arrest that had been issued for him for 3 counts of rape, 2 of attempted murder, and 1 of assault. The charges had been laid by 2 former partners of Molemo's and related to incidents the women said had occurred before Molemo was imprisoned for the culpable homicide charges. Molemo was granted bail in this matter, and in July 2024, the NPA announced that they were withdrawing the charges against the man, as upon reviewing the evidence available at the time, they did not feel there was a reasonable prospect of a successful prosecution. As I said in the beginning, I wanted to cover this case because I didn't think that nearly enough focus was put on the victims of vehicular crimes. Countless people are killed in hit and runs daily, for instance, and never reported on. Many people die in accidents that are caused by drunk drivers, and unless they are well known, the families of these victims often feel like they have no recourse. The feeling seems to be, it's just another car accident. But there are very few true accidents. Very often, these deaths are as a result of significant negligence. Things like cell phone use, speeding, and driving while intoxicated, which even a child could probably tell you would lead to the deaths of others. Vehicular deaths caused by these factors are not accidents. They are entirely preventable. And in my opinion, they should be prosecuted far more often when the perpetrator survives and their victims don't. For the most part, I wanted to cover this case because the 6 direct victims and the huge number of secondary and tertiary victims really didn't get much focus. They became almost a backup cast to the perpetrator because of his fame. I hope that in some way I've been able to introduce you to the human beings that these 4 boys were in this episode. Boys who were just coming home from school, excited for the Soccer World Cup, thinking about what their minds eat for lunch at home, talking and chatting among themselves, hopeful for the future, doing the things all teenage boys do, until they weren't, and they were cut down in the most painful and traumatic of ways, and their lives became a footnote in the story of a fallen star. Andile Mthombeni, Prince Mohube, Mlungisi Swai, and Mpumelelo Masemola, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon. Thanks again to this week's sponsor, When Change Happens. To hear amazing stories of change, go to changepodcasts.co.za. I'm sure you'll enjoy the show.